Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for September 23rd, 2021. Many weeks now I've been talking about electric highways to the stars, and some interesting events over the past week or so have found some spots on Jupiter. And so this is related to the electric rivers to the stars and electric highways to the stars. Here's the situation, and I think it's rather comical that they would even announce this with a straight face. An amateur using what is about a 240 millimeter telescope, that means the aperture is about 10 inches. That's like a little kid's telescope. I mean, it's a nice telescope. I wouldn't mind having it. It's a very nice telescope. But to see spots on Jupiter and take videotapes of them takes it's very good equipment for amateur. But Jupiter's a long ways away. We're right now at the brightest time of year. Jupiter in August was the very closest. But now also we just have a very good view as it gets lower in the west. But to see a spot on Jupiter, and what they're saying is, oh, a rock hit the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, and this guy took a picture of it with his camera. And then they start talking. This, by the way, is from space.com, the disinformation magazine for people that can't think. And the basic thing they sell now is sci-fi. They promote sci-fi, and that's to lure in a lot of listeners, a lot of readers, or readership, because there's nothing going on in space. I mean, if it weren't for a few individuals, clearly NASA's got nothing going on. But anyway, for them to blow this story up and to say that these are rocks hitting Jupiter's atmosphere and that they can see them from Earth is absolutely bizarre. Now, let me explain something. A rock the size they're talking about here, a small rock, would be difficult to see with that telescope on the moon, which is 250,000 miles away. I mean, you couldn't see a 100-foot boulder on the surface of the moon. You couldn't see potentially a 1,000-foot boulder on the moon. But they're talking about seeing one hit the surface of Jupiter. I mean, on Jupiter, I mean, it is really a long ways away. And to quote numbers is meaningless, because all you have to understand is that this guy is looking through the atmosphere, mind you, this young amateur. And I applaud. I'm not giving grief to the amateur astronomer. Don't get me wrong. What I'm stressing here is that the explanation that somehow this amateur astronomer saw a particle hitting the surface of Jupiter is beyond bizarre, because there are small moons of Jupiter which cannot be seen with this same telescope. So, it's just very strange. But what does this have to do with electric highways to the stars? Well, kind of everything, because what they're really seeing are the electrical discharges. And when an object comes in to Jupiter, Jupiter has its own proton wind capacitor. In other words, Jupiter is a small star. And I've said this from back in the very beginning when my first published papers came out, 1979-ish. I was saying, yeah, Jupiter is a small star. It's not, you shouldn't even call it a planet. It's a twin star to our star, the sun, what we call the sun. And it's about one-tenth the size of our sun, one-tenth the diameter of the sun, and it has very similar composition. So Jupiter would have been one of the very original members of our solar system, with all of the rest coming later by the process of capture, something that I haven't mentioned for quite a while in this show, that all the planets in our solar system were accumulated by the process of capture. and that is a gravitational process where you need two bodies, the Sun and Jupiter being the best ones, the best pair in the solar system, or it could be the Sun and Saturn as another potential pair for gathering, for collecting wayward objects that are floating through outer space. The solar capacitor extends out into what we call the Kuiper Belt, so this is way beyond Pluto. And Jupiter is discharging the solar capacitor, as are all the planets. That's why when they have, for example, we align Earth with Jupiter, which happened in early August, we get those tremendous winds. Remember all those tremendous winds, straight line winds and tornadoes, etc., in early August? That's what was causing it. So we had the return current sheet of August, we had the alignment with Jupiter, and we had a full moon activity at the time, which is is not a big a factor as a new moon passing. Okay, so anyway, that's one source of power and energy for Jupiter. Secondly, Jupiter has its own proton-supported wind coming off the planet, and these were measured directly. This is not fantasy, this is not projection, this is not theory. It's explained by my theoretical work, but it was measured directly. It's actually published in Science magazine, and the observation was made by the Voyager spacecraft. When they came by, they could see the proton wind coming off Jupiter, but of course nobody wanted to talk about that. So you have two electrical phenomena going on in Jupiter. One is the cross solar system discharge, which is very large, draws a lot of power down that line connecting with Jupiter. And the second source of voltage in the region of Jupiter is because of Jupiter's own fusion-supported proton wind, which creates its own capacitor. And the way it sits is that Io, the moon, Io, the nearest moon of the four Galilean moons, it lies closer to Jupiter and inside Jupiter's magnetic field. And so there's some very significant interactions going on there. But the other moons of Jupiter lie outside of this. But getting back to these rock objects that come into Jupiter, the situation is that they are small comets coming in. And I'll be talking in a minute about Schumacher-Levy 9, which was a comet in, I believe it was like 1997. And was famous for breaking up into many little pieces, 21 to be exact. That's what was visible. And when these pieces of the comet, which are not dirty snowballs, by the way, they're just rocky material, when they came into the backside of Jupiter, they made tremendous, tremendous explosions. Well, a rock like that, or a piece of material coming into the atmosphere of Jupiter, would not of itself, you wouldn't even see it. There would not be a mark. There wouldn't be anything that would accentuate it to be visible from Earth. Now, the spots that they're seeing are really big. I mean, they're, in terms of Jupiter itself, they're very, very visible, and they're big. They're big. I mean, they're big, broad, visible, bright areas. So to imagine that somehow a rock would cause this is just beyond absurd. What would happen to a rock if it came into Jupiter's atmosphere? It would go down in below the chemical soup that's at the surface of the upper surface of the atmosphere of Jupiter, and you wouldn't even see anything. Even the vapor trail coming into the atmosphere would not be visible, even locally, let alone from Earth. So what is going on is the $64,000 question. What is happening is that these objects, which are small, like a comet nucleus, can be very small, but the electrical size of the comet is extremely large. For example, Halley's Comet, we know from bird's eye view that it's about 7 miles long. And it has a coma that's enormous. I mean, you can see it from Earth. And so its electrical size, the size of the coma, is potentially 1 million miles across and 2 or 3 or 4 million miles long. That's the visible part. The part that you don't see, its true electrical size could be 20 million miles long. This is all caused by a little 7 mile across object in outer space. And so when these objects, even though they might be small, come into the region of Jupiter, they discharge the local capacitor of Jupiter, draw in material, and then that, when it gets close to Jupiter's upper atmosphere, is when the last discharge occurs. And all this material that's been accumulating in the tail then is visible in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. So that's what you're seeing. And that happened with Schumacher Levy 9. The comet, it was in about 1997, a very famous comet that broke into 21 pieces. And as these pieces came into the realm of Jupiter, they were water comets up until that time, just a normal water comet. And all of a sudden, as they each crossed that boundary coming into Jupiter, they one by one turned into sulfur dioxide comets. Now, ask yourself, would these comet pieces have layering such that just as they came into this exact region around Jupiter, they would magically change from water comets to sulfur dioxide comets? Well, nobody has ever seen a sulfur dioxide comet before, ever, in the history of the world. In the history of observing comets, nobody has ever seen a water comet instantaneously turn into a sulfur dioxide comet. Why is it a sulfur dioxide comet? Because that's the species, that's the abundant species, chemical species in the region around Jupiter. And so when these things are discharging the local capacitor around Jupiter, that's the chemical element that's there, that's the ion that's available to be drawn in as the tail material. And then when these hit the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, they exploded with such intensity that the Russian scientists who had their instruments trained out, including X-ray monitoring equipment, the reflection was so great that the X-rays leaving these explosions were reflected off the moons of Jupiter on the far side of Jupiter, and that was enough reflection to be detected at Earth. It was incredible amount of energy. So the Russian scientists were able to calculate how much energy was expended, and it was more energy than if these rocks that were part of Schumacher Levy 9, these 21 pieces were made out of pure uranium and exploded, they wouldn't produce that much energy. So what happened is this huge amount of energy is being dissipated from the fusion-based capacitor around Jupiter. And that's what caused these tremendous X-ray jolts of lightning and producing all of this X-ray activity. That's what it was. It wasn't from something that happened from this stupid little rock. What does this have to do with electric rivers to the electric highways to the stars? Well, now, if you were going to fly around the solar system using electromagnetic propulsion systems, you would want to find the locations where the electric fields are the greatest and therefore have the greatest propensity to discharge and therefore cause the greatest electromagnetic fields, primarily magnetic fields, and that's the medium. Remember, that's like the swimmer in the water. I was talking last week, 2 weeks ago, that the swimmer in the water is a non-inertial propulsion system because the swimmer is not expelling anything to go forward. He's using energy against a medium. And so that's the same situation with electromagnetic propulsion systems, as you are pushing against a medium, and that medium, it happens to be the magnetic field. And so anyway, the planets, especially the gas planets, or more precisely the small stars like Jupiter and Saturn, have their own local electric field. So you could navigate quite nicely around these bodies. And this is one of the techniques. I talk about this in the book, The Diamond Principle, where you have a space station and a central tube. And that tube is adjusted so that it discharges the local capacitor. And that current passing through the tube pushes against the magnetic field and in a form of propulsion. And the reason this is important, now I talked about specific impulse, and the reason this is important is for space travel is because for you to leave Earth's orbit is going to take a lot of energy. A lot of work has to be done to move any kind of object away from Earth's orbit. But if you can use the naturally occurring capacitor around a planet like Earth, like Jupiter, because Earth has 17 I call them local electrical batteries in my weather book. But if you can use these to your advantage, then you can, in a sense, use a very low force over a very long period of time to spirit these space stations away from planet Earth without ever using chemical rockets at all. And it's going to take some time, but of course, if you're in an autonomous space station, like a space wheel, so to speak, with artificial gravity, etc., if you're in an autonomous space station, then you have all the time in the world, all the time in the universe, because you're, in a sense, not going anywhere. you're in your spacecraft, and that's where you're going to be for a very long period of time. And so taking a long period of time to spirit this, that's kind of it's not a scientific word, but the idea is that you're using a very low force over a very long period of time and doing the same thing as a chemical rocket would with a high energy burn over a short period of time. So now I'm going to divert a little bit to, it's kind of an interesting topic, understanding that this is the way you have to travel in outer space and using the naturally occurring energy sources that are in outer space, just like the ancient mariners learned that if you put a sail up and you sailed with the wind, you could get someplace. The only problem is, of course, back then, is if you got someplace, you had to find the wind patterns that would get you back to where you began. And they did that. Those are the trade winds. But this brings up the point, if you were an alien, like we will be someday, like if say, Earthlings go to Mars, then we will be aliens. And so the question, are there aliens? Well, yeah, we will be the aliens. And so it's a perfect example of somebody crossing the great void, so to speak, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, using those terms, to get to another place to basically set up shop and live. There's an interesting passage in the Colbran, and it talks about crossing the great void. Now, I've talked about this on my show before, but that's a very interesting terminology, because if you were crossing the ocean, you wouldn't call it the great void, because there's an ocean there. You would call it the great pond or the great ocean or the endless ocean, or you would have some term describing the ocean. But a great void means nothing. People cross the great void to get to planet Earth. And apparently it was not exactly a fun ride from what they described, that not many people made it. And so crossing the great void, was that from someplace in our solar system? Was it someplace outside our solar system? What was crossing the great void all about? But apparently that was a, you know, at least one of the seeding processes for human beings on planet Earth, according to the Colburn. And once again, Yvonne Whiteman's really excellent work on the Colburn has brought that out in one of her excellent, excellent papers, white papers on the Colburn, all worth reading. Yvonne Whiteman is Y-A-V-O-N-N-E. Whiteman is just like it sounds, the color white, W-H-I-T-E-M-A-N. And they're right now being presented on a webpage, but just look up that name, you'll find them. But one of them discusses about the origin of the human race, and one of the concepts that's presented in the Colburn is that the originators of the human race came across the great void. In other words, outer space. So that great void, was that intergalactic? Was that from another galaxy? I mean, the great void is kind of, it could have been from a local planet, like, for example, say, Mars. Even crossing the great void between Mars and Earth would be, in all due respect, the great void. So it's hard to say, but that's an indicator that at least some of the ancestries of the human race came from outer space. And of course, that's not proof, but there again, who has proof of anything? It's, to me, it's a better story than the one of, you know, the little ape person being crawling around in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and that's the source of the human race. I mean, there, that, you know, finding a jawbone of a little monkey that's 2 billion years old or some million, whatever the story is, the Leakey's story, doesn't make much sense at all to me. I mean, there's it's about as remote as people coming across the great void in a spaceship and landing on Earth. I mean, that's just as believable to me. There's just about as much proof, or little proof, if you want to say it that way. But the whole idea of traveling between the star systems, based on what I've been telling you about low specific impulse engines, in other words, the long-term, very slow acceleration. And, for example, probably a year or two ago, I was talking about how you get to the next star system. And if you could accelerate at 1G, that's one Earth gravity of acceleration, the equivalent, and towards the next star system, you just did this continually, and if you could do this with a passive electromagnetic non-inertial propulsion system, then you could get to the next star system, which is about 4 light years away. You could get there in about 7 years. That's less time than it took for a lot of the spacecraft to get out to the planets they were designed to go to. So it's really not a long time. I mean, when you start thinking about it, 7 years to get to the next star system, and then we'd have a bird's eye view. I mean, we would have a view of the next star system. That would be the equivalent of what the Voyagers did with the outer planets, starting with Jupiter and the Grand Tour. That was just amazing science. I mean, before that, we had very, very rudimentary, very vague knowledge of the planets. And now we have detailed studies of these planets with spacecraft. You had the Galileo probe that went around Jupiter, studying it for years and years. And then you had the Cassini mission that went to Saturn for years and years, which I think is still there. I don't think they crashed that into the planet Saturn at all. I think that's a myth, because they didn't want people to get a hold of data. They wanted everybody to think, oh, it just went away, and and that's the end of that. No, you wouldn't take a billion-dollar spacecraft that's out around Saturn and crash it into the atmosphere of Saturn. I'm sorry. I don't believe it. Not for a second. But so this brings up again the very interesting point that when you come into that next star system with your non-inertial propulsion system, what you're going to try and do is look for a comet, and you're going to steer yourself to come in and hook into the electrical discharge of that comet to slow down. So where would you look for potential alien activity if you were looking in our own solar system? And the answer would be around comets. And the very reason is because they could derive power from the discharge of that's occurring in the comet, the local electrical discharge. They could derive power. They could use it for propulsion, for mobility. They could use it to accelerate out of the solar system. When the comet got in a certain direction, they could use the discharge that's over a couple million miles long as an accelerating track to zip out of the solar system and get a good start on that trip across the great void, moving to the other star system, and then hook up to the electric rivers, to the stars that flow between our star and their star. And so, yeah, if you were looking for alien activity, you would look around, especially larger comets. Comets that are active all the time, there probably are solar systems out there, or star systems, that have active comets that are there all the time. For example, an interesting case in point would be when Venus was in our own solar system, ravaging the planets, meandering through the solar system as accounted for by the Mayans and the Incas and the Aztecs and the Chinese and the Hindu, the India, the ancestors of India, the Himalayan people, the American Southwest natives. All of these people talked about the long-term presence, probably for many hundreds of years, the comet Venus in the atmosphere, but not in the atmosphere, but in the solar system. But imagine the activity, and plus you would have been able to see this from other solar systems, so they would have known that a planet was actively forming in our solar system and potentially headed out, because this was going to last many hundreds of years. So a seven-year trip across the great void, okay, now you got a way to break when you come into the solar system. So, you know, the history that you are taught, and let me just say this, maybe there's people listening, they're going for the first time, ah, this guy's crazy, he's talking about aliens, comets. And, you know, if it's the first time you've heard something like this, because you're really poorly educated, I guess that's the best way to put it. You don't know anything. You've been taught a bunch of crap. You think you're smart. And when you hear real information, you have no idea how to interpret it because it's contrary to what you thought of your education because you're so smart. And, I'm just being blunt and I'm being truthful. It's really true. People think they're smart. You know, you might talk to some PhDs in astrophysics that wouldn't have a clue about what I'm talking about because they don't know anything. They're book learning smart, but street dumb. And they're kept that way on purpose. It's a controlling mechanism. You just don't want those grad students to be too smart. Anyway, okay, now there's another technique here that is used commonly, and it would be available also, and that is a gravitational assist. It's used to accelerate spacecraft. For example, Venus has been used. The moon has been used. Jupiter has been used. I don't think really Mars has been used for gravitational assist. But what happens is there's in a two-body system, which would be Jupiter and the Sun, There's a two, using two bodies, it does not work with one, but you can get a gravitational assist and accelerate a spacecraft to much higher velocities. And what it is, it's an energy exchange. For example, if you use Jupiter, Jupiter loses a little bit of energy and the spacecraft gains it. And it takes a two-body gravitational system to cause this to happen. On the converse side, when a comet is coming into the solar system or an object, any kind of piece of material at all, the reverse can happen if it comes on the reverse orbit, comes in exactly the opposite direction, then the object will lose energy, Jupiter will pick it up, and it'll capture the object into the solar system. And it's one of the great dichotomies of astronomy and astrophysics and space sciences. They regularly use this gravitational assist to get out to the other planets, but deny the idea that an object could be captured into the solar system, and that capture is the primary mechanism for formation of objects in the solar system like planets. And, of course, they don't know, because they're thinking that stuff accumulated 4.5 billion years ago from a meandering dust cloud, which doesn't work. By the way, any computer models, that even computer models don't work. Anyway, there's all kinds of problems with that. All of the planets spin backwards of what that model would predict. Nobody has ever visibly seen a dust cloud collapse and form this magical solar system. It lacks verification. Let's just put it that way. A little while ago, I was talking about the autonomous space stations moving around and using the discharge of the local capacitor around Earth. It would be the local electrical batteries, of which there are 17 that I've identified. And around the solar system, it would just be discharging the solar capacitor or in the vicinity of Jupiter. But I think unless you were really prepared, you would want to stay away from Jupiter. It has a tremendous amount of radiation, very, very dangerous environment. Unless you had protection from radiation, then Jupiter would not be a good candidate. You wouldn't want to get too near Jupiter. But in the wider solar system, the trick would be to discharge the solar capacitor through the central tube of the space station, and once again, over a very long period of time, move the space station, change its orbit. And that would be a way of navigating, as there again, the electric rivers to the stars. In that case, it would be orbiting our star and changing your orbit, eventually maybe coming back to Earth, or maybe visiting other planets, coming by for a tour of Mars. That would probably be pretty spectacular from a tourist point of view, is simply to go by Mars in a space station and look at it at point-blank range, just like a low Earth orbit object would see the Earth as a very beautiful, everybody who's in space talks about how beautiful the Earth is from a distance, and Mars would be equally amazing. Even though it has little to no atmosphere, you could see dust storms, you could see dust devils. Mars is covered with dust devils, and there again, a dust devil is nothing more than an electrical discharge between the surface and the ionization of gas around the surface, the base of the discharge, and when it starts, when it finds a path upwards, it's a narrow path, that's the hurricane, or that's the dust devil, or the water spout, if you're on planet Earth. All of those phenomena, those atmospheric phenomena, are the same. Also, the tornadoes that race across the surface of the sun, the Russian scientists discovered back in the 1990s, early 1990s, they were observing these, And that's one of the reasons why they were very interested in my work, is because it explained what they were seeing. They had no idea what's this tornadoes moving across the surface of the sun. And they looked just like a waterspout, which is the characteristic thing about a waterspout, if you've ever seen one out over the ocean, is that they don't have a cloud at the top. There's just this long, mile-long tube of water, like a tornado, zipping along the water, and at the base, the water is just flying around. They're very dangerous if you get close to them. And then they'll pick up fish or anything that's on the surface and suck it up and throw it up in the air. And this stuff comes down miles and miles away. But there again, it's all the same discharge process powered ultimately by the sun. And getting back to Jupiter and the spots that they were seeing, they're the same phenomena, the tornadoes on the sun, the tornadoes on Earth, waterspouts on Earth, over the ocean, hurricanes, tornadoes, cyclonic storms on Mars, cyclones on Mars. If you look out over the desert, the twisters, also the dust devils, which are common in the American Southwest. Or if you look on Mars, the dust devils, they also call them dust devils there. All of these phenomena are the same issue. You have a discharge, or let me add some more here, above a volcano. You have tornadoes coming out the bare top of a caldera in a volcano. It's an electrical discharge, ionizes the gases down at the base. They go up the column, the Coriolis force, causes them to spin. It's the same type of spin as water going down the drain. In the bathroom, the swirling that occurs when the water goes down the drain. And the same thing happens with hurricanes, tornadoes, cyclones, himicanes, which are a hurricane over land. And it's just that it's if it ionizes the air enough, then you can form the same low-pressure cell. And this process continues over land, so I call them himicanes. Anyway, all of these processes are exactly the same. They all have their same root source of energy in the vertical electric field discharge. So, the same process, the very same process. And on the surface of Jupiter, when they see the spots forming there, that's because the material is being drawn into the objects that are coming in to that region of Jupiter. Jupiter has its own, as I said, has its own electric field. If Jupiter were off by itself, not in our solar system, it would have its own sun-like electrical capacitor discharge system. The would be a proton wind-supported capacitor, and all of the effects that you see would be occurring also just around Jupiter if it were isolated. It has two discharges. One is that its own discharge because of its own fusion wind, proton wind, and supported capacitor. And then it also is in the sun's solar capacitor and discharges that. So Jupiter is a bit of a complicated animal in that it has a mixture of energy sources electrically. And, of course, these generate the magnetic field. Standard science doesn't understand this. They believe that somehow these plasma magnetic fields just self-generate and are there. Well, it's absolutely absurd. They don't understand physics. This is physics 101. This is not physics complicated, higher level physics, electromagnetism. This is basic physics. And these people don't understand it. They don't have a clue. Okay. Now, let's take a bit of a segue here and talk about what it would be like to be on one of these space stations. Well, it's spinning, and so that gives you artificial gravity. And you could have it set exactly, so it's the same as Earth gravity. Or you could set it less, or you could set it more. That would be interesting, maybe a way for training for athletes to have additional G-forces so that they had to work against those, and then when they got back to an Earth gravity, it would be much simpler, much easier to manage. So just imagine like a weightlifter who would then be lifting more weight and practicing, and when they get back to Earth, it would be easier, or any type of sport. It would be interesting, too, that you could have, say, a tennis match in outer space that would have a much bigger court at a much lower gravity, let's say one-half G or one-quarter G, and playing a tennis match, but with a much bigger tennis court, and the ball would have very different characteristics. It would go farther. It would not drop as much. It would be an interesting game of tennis. Okay, so anyway, living on a space station like that, now if you look at the one that I'm working with, it has seven cylinders, and the cylinders are, say, 300 feet long, and maybe 40 feet in diameter, something like that, 40 or 50 feet in diameter. And so you could have, and this is in a spinning space station, so you would have artificial gravity. And so you would have the central pod. Now imagine, there's something too, you're probably having a hard time imagining how these are put together. So anyway, take coins. Take some coins, or it could be any kind of coins, quarters or nickels or pennies, whatever, all just so they're all the same size. And say take seven pennies, put one down on the table and then put six around it, and they fit tight together. And so that's one of the interesting things about just spatial coordination, is that seven is a natural number. So you have one cylinder in the middle and then six surrounding it. The six surrounding it would be habitation for living, etc., like apartments or hotel rooms or offices, work offices, etc. And then the central one would be the life support systems, the gardens for growing food. And it's interesting, apparently there are studies that have been done showing that romaine lettuce is one of the best plants for returning oxygen from carbon dioxide. So you could have, like my grow tower is a grow tower scenario in a space station in that central pod, which would then recycle oxygen, the carbon dioxide from the humans breathing out, and then it would recycle it back into oxygen and also grow the food. Using sunlight as the energy source for growing the food. And then also in the center, you would have maybe gymnasiums, restaurants, and other essentials as part of the life support system. But the overall effect is then you would have, say, a 300-foot-long tube, 40 foot in diameter, and you'd have seven of these bundled together, and then those seven in a bundle would be connected at the ends to other bundles to make up a space station. And so anyway, that's the plan. But the idea is that whenever you see space stations, and I'm kind of amazed at this, you can even going back to the original Wernher von Braun space station, which was used for the Stanley Kubrick movies, 2001. And then there was a sequel, and I don't think Kubrick actually produced the second on the follow-on. It was 2010, which, of course, is long past. And we didn't do any of this stuff in those movies. But anyway, and there's some modern space station designs that people are talking about putting up into space, but none of them have really efficient pieces. If you look at them, they're very complicated sets of pieces, which don't lend themselves well to putting things in space. And that's one thing that I went with when I went with the tube designs, putting the tubes and the launch system and everything, is that the whole system depends on one part. There's only one part and part size, and they're all in tubes. And so anyway, and also a large scale, that's the other thing. It's just like my wing generator. If you're going to do something, do it so that it's scalable. And the other ones I've seen are not scalable. They don't have, you can scale anything, but is it going to work well? Well, no, it's not going to work well because the one that's existing today only has these little teeny pods and very small. So anyway, scalability is something that's very important. And so once again, that's something I take into consideration in the original design, not in some afterthought and some secondary design down the road. Okay. So anyway, imagine you're in one of these tubes. It's the size, for people who are not familiar with 300 feet long, that's the size of a football field and about 40 feet in diameter. So this is, imagine living in something that's as long as a football field. And we all live in something that's much smaller, a house or say an apartment complex, where you would have a city block. Even a big, big apartment complex would be a city block long and not 300 feet long. So these tubes are very large, but they're very easy to get into space. That's the entire point. You can build them on Earth, the original ones, and you could even manufacture these in outer space afterwards. And that's something I talked about before. I talked about it last week, about the manufacturing and the ability in outer space to make things using manufacturing processes in outer space because they work better. Say you're building a carbon fiber space station, then it's actually much easier and much more, it's much stronger if you build it in outer space, because the carbon fiber, building the carbon fiber itself, the fibers, is a process that works better in outer space. And then the molding of the carbon fiber, the curing of the carbon, carbon fiber works much better in outer space. So once you get this process going, then you'll be dealing with structures in outer space. Okay. The other thing about carbon fiber, and there's other materials, aramids, and all, there's the modern materials are almost endless, having amazing properties, hardness and stiffness and rigidity. And here's one of the biggest ones for designing with, say, carbon. It does not stretch or shrink with temperature, whereas metal does. Anytime you build something with metal and it has to react to temperatures that are extreme, like imagine the alleged Apollo landers that were made, had a lot of metal in them. The side towards the sun would be very hot, and then the side away from the sun would be very cold. And these would all have to exist in the same structure, and they would be responding to temperatures. There are aircraft, for example, the Blackbird is a very good example, that is made out of metal. This is the high-altitude spy plane jet out of the 1950s. And when it takes off, the metal, because it's going to expand, the rivets are actually rattling in the aircraft. Because when they get up to altitude and get going fast enough, the sheets of metal are going to heat up and expand and close up those gaps. So a truly amazing technology, but using metal. If you were to make that same airplane out of carbon fiber, then you would have a situation that the plane under very high temperatures would not change shape. It's not going to expand. and say you have, anytime you have fittings in an aircraft and the say something that big is changing shape, you have to account for that in the design, because just a small gap in the structure is going to cause vibration because the other parts are not going to fit properly anymore. So metal craft, especially in outer space, are not really good. But carbon fiber, one of the benefits of that is that it does not change shape with temperature. So once again, these modern materials are just great for what you need for construction in outer space. Plus the mechanism of making the materials themselves. And so that brings up the entire question of where do you get these materials in outer space? And that's a topic for another show. I'm not going to go into that right now. But getting back to the idea of living on a space station, the Stanley Kubrick movie 2001 was very interesting. But if you take a look at that space station and all of the parts that would have to be launched from Earth to make that space station, is really, really impractical. Really impractical. Although it would be nice, but it's the curved surface. One of the best scenes in that movie is where the astronaut is jogging to keep healthy. He's jogging. So he jogs around the space station. And it's kind of an interesting situation. Say the rotation of the spacecraft is in one direction. If you run in the same direction as rotation of the spacecraft, because you're moving faster than the rotation rate, you're going to weigh more. If you run backwards, in other words, in the opposite direction of the rotation of the spacecraft, you could get to the point where you were weightless. Your weight would decrease as you ran backwards in the relative to the direction of the rotating spacecraft. But anyway, that was an interesting example where you would have continuous floor coming underneath you as you're jogging in this space station. It also brings up the question, as if you're in an autonomous space station for years and years and years, or decades, and this would be to the point where civilizations would be born and not know anything different. Earth would be something completely foreign to them, getting out of a spaceship, out of this fixed environment, and having trees and water and lakes and go canoeing and camping and, you know, have a campfire. This would be completely foreign to you if you were used to living in a space station. So imagine that, the long-term effects of people living in a space station. The other thing is, on Earth, we have protective magnetic fields that protect us from radiation from outer space. We have hundreds and hundreds of aspects to the environment, all of which are necessary for your well-being. There are just hundreds of the atmospheric level of humidity, for example, or the availability of salt, sodium chloride, with all of the other minerals that are mixed in, what we call table salt, which is necessary for your well-being, and interestingly enough, a little element called iodine. There was a time when people first came to the coast of the United States, for example, and most people in the world lived near the coast. Not that many people lived away from the coast. But from time immemorial, there's been a trade in salt. But in the United States, when people first came and settled the Great Plains, for example, there was a disease, and it was because of the lack of iodine. And it was people would develop a protrusion in their neck. And it became common, and until they found out that what this was caused by was lack of iodine. And you get that iodine from sea salt, and which is a very interesting thing also. A lot of people, for example, will use Himalayan salt because it has a very good mineral blend, and it's very healthy for you. Sodium chloride by itself, sodium chloride in table salt, is really very bad for you. And that's where this myth of salt is bad for you comes from. Because the salt that's been processed, they're taking all the minerals out, all the minerals that are beneficial, leaving only that white sodium chloride, and it's very bad for you to eat pure sodium chloride as seasoning for your food. But your body needs it. The other thing is, the reason I was mentioning Himalayan salt, it's kind of a pinkish color, but it does not have iodine, which means that the oceans that were on Earth at the time that formed, who knows, millions, billions of years ago, and then that solidified in caves, etc., which are now up in high in the Himalayan mountains. And there's other mines like this in Colorado showing that these mountain ranges were far below the ocean at one period of time. But the Himalayan salt does not have iodine, so you still need a source of iodine. You cannot eat just Himalayan salt. It's missing some important elements. Okay, well, I'm about out of time here this week. I've got a couple minutes left. So I'm going to talk again at the end of the show. I always try and encourage you to get the Whole House Water Filter. It's on my sales page, jmccwaterfilters.com. And use the promotion code at checkout for 10% discount. Use the promotion code JMCC and just put that in when you're at checkout. No matter what you purchase on the webpage, some people are still buying the replacement filter elements for the gravity feed waters filters. Here's an interesting product. It's really selling. I'm surprised. And it's a build your own water filter, where you go out and buy a container, a 5-gallon container, or a 1 or 2 or 3 gallon container, or a 10-gallon container that has a cover and that's stackable. And then you buy the kit from me that is, it has 2 or 4 or 10 filter elements plus a stainless steel spigot. And then you make your own water filter, and people are buying those. And they're using them like at the cabin, for camping, for emergency. And they're very inexpensive. They're the least expensive one is like $99. It comes with 2 filter elements and a stainless steel spigot and directions on how to make these. So anyway, that's been a big seller. I'm surprised, but who knows? That's what the people want. And then replacement filter elements for the gravity feed. That's the new JMCC HI filter elements, which are brand new and not so, now they're not so brand new anymore. They've been around for quite a while. And then the whole house water filter, which you need so that you're not showering, breathing in that vapor or showering into that chemical soup. You need filtration for the hot water in your house, the cold water, with the whole house water filter. All available on my webpage. Once again, the coupon code JMCC. The website, jmccwaterfilters.com, and of course my other page, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.